Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags. I've got 30 minutes on South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. Interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Tuesday, the 13th of August. Coming up on the program, new car hijacking fears here in Gauteng, how the Companies Amendment Act will expose pay disparity, patients in South Africa still struggling to access life-saving cancer treatment, and how much whiskey does it take to create an award-winning garden? And this leads our program today. The National Community Police Board of South Africa warning that hijackers are increasingly targeting victims on off and on ramps on South Africa's busiest highways, particularly here in Gauteng. More now from Siyanda Biela, who speaks for the board. And firstly, welcome. And why particularly are on and off ramps becoming so dangerous?
It has obviously became a worrying factor for us when people have been targeting motorists who are traveling between the peak hours of the morning, traveling to work, traveling home after hours, where some of the places have been noted as hotspots or hijacking hotspots. Obviously, these strategy or this modus operandi that they are using is targeting more on women who are driving cars, not mostly men, it's mostly women, because they are feeling that they are vulnerable. Those are the people who are more attacked than the young women, most especially. But they also have targeted number of cars that they actually target. You know, your Polos, your SUVs, your VW SUVs, your Tiguans, but most probably driven by women. So especially this thing happens on your pickup points, your stops and goes, your robots coming into town. So it has been a serious issue for us when it comes to Gauteng. We have an increasing number of people who have been victimized in the issue of these hijacking spots. Mm. It's an issue for us in Western Cape, but we are urging the community to be always vigilant. If you feel that it's not safe, try and pass the robot as safely as you can to avoid being a victim of such hitchhikers or the people who are spanging windows to collect any valuables in your car.
Does the board believe the situation is getting worse?
The belief is that it's a general consensus, Jeremy, that in South Africa, we have a lot of people who are using an excuse of being unemployed to actually do criminal activities, which is a blasphemy for me. So we are very worried that there's a lot of people and there's a growing number of people who are now migrants on the streets, who are begging on the corners and the robots of our communities. So unfortunately, there's nothing we can do. We can't chase them away. We have your Human Rights Commission. You'll be banging on your door the next morning after we've done that. But we are urging our motorists, as I'm saying, as it increases, as a lot of people are now being migrants, as a lot of people are now being on the streets, we urge our people not to actually be very vigilant and do not flash anything like a bag, a laptop. Do not leave it on an open place or platform so that they are able to view it from the window. So try and pack your things on the boot of the car to avoid. Do not leave your bags on the chair of the passenger chair or your chair or a phone on the dash or whatever the case may be to avoid attracting them to your car.
Are there sufficient measures in place to prevent hijackings, and are you confident in the ability of law enforcement, particularly around those hotspots, whether it be Gauteng or the Western Cape, to actually deal with the problem, or have they become engulfed?
We are very positive that our policemen and women are doing the best that they can, but obviously with the information given by us as the community police boards to attract them to say, go to this hotspot, these are the issues that are there. But obviously the policemen and women can't be always there. We've seen changes. We've seen a drop in KZN with regards to the carjackings. It has dropped with a whipping 17-16%. We've seen in Eastern Cape again another 5-6% drop. So it shows that as measures are put in such provinces, there is a drop. But also, it's not the work of the South African Police Service alone. We urge the local teams, which are your municipal police, your metro polices, your RTI, to also assist us in guarding our hotspots and ensuring that our people are good. Because we understand, we all say it is within the two times of the day, the morning rush hour, secondly the afternoon or evening rush hour, where people are coming from work. So we've seen decreases in two provinces, Western Cape, KwaZulu-Natal. We're just worried about Gauteng, Western Cape and the Northwest and the Free State with regards to that, especially with the provinces who are neighboring the borders towards other country, our neighboring countries.
Is there anything specific that makes highways in Gauteng attractive to hijackers, particularly, as you've mentioned, during peak hours?
The problem that I think we face is in Gauteng, we have a lot of on and off ramps which have been flagged as major hotspots for hijacking. But unfortunately, if you've driven there, you would understand the fluctuation of the traffic that is there. So maybe one of the strategies that we can use is to get our people to join and do some lift clubs, so that you don't have one person in one car and then it starts making freeway going to, towards one of the same direction, towards one of the same company in Pretoria, in Acadia. So let's all try and promote the issue of lift clubs, so that we are all in one car and we let the flow of the traffic go more. Because if there's more cars there, obviously there'll be stops and go. That is also giving an opportunity for a criminal to actually target you enough to even victimize you on that road. So our issue of traffic has always been an issue, especially with regards to, as I've said, also regards to the common perception that during dark times, which is in the morning and in the evening, you see that they try and walk around the freeways to identify those who are most vulnerable.
Siyanda Biela, thank you very much indeed from the National Community Police Board. I appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
All right, let's move to transport now from health matters, or should I say from health matters to transport. And the cancer advocacy group, the Cancer Alliance, has launched legal action against the Gauteng Health Department to try and compel it to spend more than R750 million that was initially set aside by the provincial treasury last year to tackle its radiation, oncology and surgical backlog. Now, at the same time, while that is happening, there are growing concerns that the disease itself is being shunted to the margins in terms of its notifiability. Zodwa Setoli is the head of advocacy at the NGO Cancer and joins me on the program now. And firstly then, can you give me the broad scope of your concerns?
You know, cancer in South Africa is generally growing. It's a growing concern as there are increased incidence and mortality rates. Despite this, cancer is not on that list of the high priority as mortality rates for other diseases such as TB or HIV. So this is the problem. And also another problem, broken equipment that results in long waiting period, which lead to the possible preventable deaths. So those are the main problem. And also, Jeremy, so you find that the patient, they've got a long waiting period before they start the treatment. Sometimes we are being contacted by the patients and their families that they've been waiting maybe for 9 months before they start their cancer treatment and worried that the cancer maybe have spread to other parts of the body.
Maybe the more simple of the two problems is the broken equipment. We can talk about the list in just a moment. But what type of equipment are we talking about and why does it find itself in such a poor condition?
I don't think I'm the right person to answer the question why those machines are in a bad conditions. I'm talking about the radiation machines here.
And when your organization raises those questions, what sort of answer do you get?
I must say, say, you know, as cancer, we work very close with oncology departments. What normally happens, Jeremy, patients and the families, they will contact us about the problem, and then we will contact that relevant oncology department. Usually they will respond, you know, and say, okay, we will contact the patients. And when we follow up, you will find that really the patient has been hurt. But sometimes, not always, but I'll say majority of the cases after we have intervened are being helped.
What sort of efforts are being made to get cancer onto that list that you refer to?
We are constantly in contact with the Department of Health, raising our concern. And in such a way, what we have done, though I know this is the National Department Health problem, but as cancer, what we have done, we're working with the provinces now, which are the implementers of the policies of the Department of Health. So we are in the process of signing the memorandum of understanding with all the provinces, hoping that it will address all the problems we are talking about. And another thing, Jeremy, what we have done as cancer, we've got a cancer information desk in oncology department, not in all the provinces. So what happened, those information desks are being managed by cancer volunteers. So, you know, patients, they will come to those help desks and ask their questions and raise their concern, and we deal with those concerns. So that's what we are doing as Cancer Association of South Africa.
I suppose that's about as much as that as you can do at the moment. You talk about a worrying increase in prevalence of cancer. What specific type of cancer are we talking about?
So we work very close, Jeremy, with a National Cancer Registry. So when you look at the top five cancers that affect men and women, so this is according to the statistic of National Cancer Registry updated in 2020. For female, we look at the breast, cervical cancer, colorectal, uterus, and melanoma cancers. Those are the five top five cancers. And when we look at the male, a cancer that affects more men is prostate, colorectal again, lung, melanoma, and non-Hodgkin lymphoma. Those are the top five cancers that affect men and women.
Mm. How do you think that your organization can change the debate around cancer in South Africa? And what sort of new approach are you looking for?
I think what is important, Jeremy, is the awareness. You know, we need to reach our communities with awareness, health education, importance of screening, importance of early diagnosis. So this is what we as cancer, we are really working hard towards, to make sure that, you know, even the department, you know, that's why I was talking about a memorandum of understanding with the provinces. We are trying to make sure that the education is out there to the communities, and even people who doesn't have even TV or radio, if the department can partner with us in health education, screening, you know, all those. So that's what we are doing as Kent at the moment, yes.
All right. Zodwa Setoli, thank you very much indeed. Head of Advocacy at the organization Cancer. I do appreciate your time today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, you'll be well aware that President Ramaphosa has signed amendments to the country's Companies Act, which essentially will require firms to disclose the pay gap between their highest and lowest paid workers. I want to give you some further commentary now, as I'm in conversation with Craig Rocher, Tax Consulting South Africa. Craig, a very warm welcome to you. So what immediate risks or concerns would companies have in accurately reporting that pay gap?
Good afternoon, Jeremy, and good afternoon to all the listeners. Yes, thank you. Look, the disclosure of executive salaries has always been in law. I think there's just now additional disclosure that's been enacted in law now, you know, with disclosing the lowest paid employee, for example. But more importantly, you know, it's now disclosing of the remuneration reports and remuneration strategies and policies that companies now have a requirement on to be disclosed within law. It's always been, you know, proposed by the King report, but now it's actually law. And I think, you know, companies must get their head around what they need to disclose and how they need to disclose that.
How difficult is it going to be for organizations to, on the one hand, ensure compliance with these requirements, but on the other, not expose themselves to reputational damage?
Yes, I think it's going to be a bit of a juggling act, you know, because it's first time law. So companies normally, you know, don't know really what to do. They will wait perhaps for others to disclose their reports first and see what they need to do. And obviously, you know, where pay gaps have been astronomically high and shareholders have been, you know, the information has perhaps been there but not pointed out to shareholders. Companies are now going to have to, you know, come clean and or come forth with all of that information and make sure their shareholders are fully aware of what executives are really earning in comparison with other lower paid employees.
Craig, of more concern if I was running a company, and mercifully I'm not, but would be how to mitigate potential backlash from employees, or the public, I guess, for that matter, when disclosing significant pay disparity, because there is no doubt in all organizations it does exist in one way or another.
Yes, absolutely. And within South Africa especially, I mean, we are seen as a poverty-stricken country, you know, where there is massive difference between top execs and very low-level, maybe unskilled employees. Absolutely. I think this is a big concern for everyone involved. And when they enacted the law years ago to disclose the executive remuneration, you know, the legislators had the intention that the executives and the board and the remuneration committee is going to do something about this, but now they and they didn't. And I think that's why they've created more law or more legislation to force them to do that. And I think it is a big concern, yes.
It's also going to, Craig, be difficult for companies, I imagine, to prioritize data accuracy and internal audits to comply with this Companies Amendment Act. How do they start doing that?
Yes, absolutely. So I think obviously your payroll plays a pivotal role here with numbers, where the highest paid employee, the lowest paid employee, averages, medians, you know, it's going to be your headcount's going to be obviously have to be very, very accurate, confirmed by probably internal, external audit to provide your average being correct and your median being correct. Obviously, from the highest executive, you know, you're going to have to look at long-term incentives and short-term incentives over and above normal day-to-day or month-to-month salaries and benefits, and obviously your lowest paid employee as well. So just to make sure your payroll is complete and accurate in terms of that. And then more importantly, I think the remuneration report and the remuneration policy and, you know, needs to be now tightened up, re-looked at, you know, what is our policy, what is our strategy in terms of remuneration to make sure it covers everything and it's watertight. When someone read this, they can understand that, because I think not just executives are going to read it now, the public is going to read it, employees are going to read it because they've got an interest in that now. And I think to make it understandable for everyone, because that's in the end what disclosure is to make it understandable to the stakeholders and shareholders.
What sort of penalties exist if companies fail to do this?
At this stage, it's very difficult to say because it's new law. You know, it's difficult to say at the moment. I'm sorry about that.
But they're going to have to be on their best behavior to make sure that they don't run foul of the law. In terms of your client base, what kind of questions are they asking of you to make sure that they're ready for the implementation of this act?
Look, we do, you know, company policies in terms of remuneration strategies. We can assist with those. So that's what the clients are asking. Is this strategy good enough? Is this policy good enough to withstand attack from shareholders, attack from the public? So I think, you know, getting your policy and your strategy really understandable, and so that it reads nicely and can be explained, and it really has your strategies in mind, in aligned with your company strategies and policies. So I think that's what the clients are asking now. I think the numbers are actually an easier law change, because that straight comes from payroll, and we hopefully your payroll is complete and accurate. But I think from a policy and a strategy point of view, your committees are going to bed this down and really understand to explain to the board what is going on there. And obviously shareholders need to approve that. And if they don't, then it's not going to look very good.
And Craig, on the flip side of this, it's surely going to be difficult for regulators to make sure that companies adhere to the new disclosure requirements. How is this going to be monitored? I mean, it's going to be hard to monitor everyone, surely. I imagine it would require at the start good internal audit processes to make sure that it's signed off.
Absolutely. I think, you know, to really, the aim of this, the legislation change, is to provide transparency. And I think, you know, if you really are open and honest about this, internal audit is going to have to play a very big role in this, to make sure the numbers are correct, to make sure your policies align with your practices, especially internal audit, as you mentioned. Your external audit will have a look at it, because they need to do it from a legislation compliance point of view. But I think internal audit is very important to really get down to the nitty-gritty detail. Absolutely.
And Craig, there's another aspect to this, the extended time limit for declaring a director delinquent. How is that going to impact corporate governance and accountability in your opinion?
Sure, yes. Look, at the moment, I think, you know, to get your directors have to obviously adhere to fiduciary duties and, you know, make sure they act in the best interest of the company. And if they don't, they can be held liable, absolutely. So I think they need to, you know, jump and make sure that their policies, remuneration policies, pay policies, where they do benchmarking, for example, is really in place. Because I think, you know, they need to make sure their side is clean in order for the shareholders to approve such a policy. And I think, you know, if they are found guilty, you know, then they've acted against the company's act requirements and obviously can be held liable with perhaps a suspension and, you know, other items imposed from the board and shareholders.
Craig, you've really explained the red flags to me just very broadly. What's your sense? Is this going to work?
From a numbers point of view, I think it's just a disclosure of a number and a percentage. So I think that is fine. And the pay gap, you know, I think at this stage, because it's not disclosed, it's really going to, I think, be the one that's targeted by shareholders. I think it can work. Obviously, companies are going to have to look at their remuneration policy and strategy. I think that's more work than the actual numbers, you know, disclose the highest paid, lowest paid, average. That's quite easy. It's just from payroll. But yeah, from a remuneration strategy and policy point of view, that's going to be the difficult one.
All right, Craig Rocha, thank you very much indeed for that from Tax Consulting SA.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, if all of that has worried you, if you're concerned, well, maybe you'd like to join me. You'd like to step outside and let's go into a nice, gentle garden, shall we? Hot on the heels of South Africa's success at the Chelsea Flower Show, landscape designer Leon Klucher has won another top prize at Asia's biggest garden show. It's the Singapore Garden Festival, and he joins me on the program now. First of all, Leon, congratulations, and maybe let's start with your inspiration for the winning garden design. It's called Between Two Worlds. How did you bring that vision to life?
What's interesting about this installation that we had to do was they told me that I'm in fantasy. So fantasy means that it's not only about plants, but it's also about lights, and it's about sound, and it's about telling a story to the public. And when I went to Singapore to do a site visit, I actually walked around their mangroves, and it was so calm and peaceful and so forgotten, in a sense, by the locals. So I decided to do a theme on the mangroves and get this fantasy world swirling around that fact. So how I came up with the theme was, you know, when you dream, there's that moment when you just fall asleep, where all your, there's no inhibitions anymore when it comes to imagination. Everything starts to flow together. Sometimes when you wake up, you think, oh my goodness, what was that dream all about? It just doesn't make sense at all. But at that moment, everything makes perfect sense. And that's the moment I wanted to capture with this garden that we built.
Wow, Leon, that you've explained that so well to me. The design at the Singapore Garden Festival, how do you think it reflects current trends in landscape design?
So this show is the biggest one in Asia. So there are three shows in the world that really count, where designers get invited to. And the first, Asia, the biggest one, it's Singapore. Europe, and kind of the whole world coming together, is Chelsea. And then the Americas, South and North America, is Philadelphia. Now, when it comes to Singapore, I also wanted to showcase not only different plants, but Singaporean plants too. I know we're South Africa there, but we're there competing for design and competing with other designers in pushing the boundaries. Then using plants, I wanted the Singaporeans to see plants, interesting plants, rare plants, but also plants that they can use in their apartments and in their gardens. So in regards to that, I pushed it towards more plants that they can use instead of using plants that are not sustainable, that you buy in the shop and actually just die because it just looks pretty for a week or so. But in that humidity and heat, it just perishes so quickly. And I've got such stunning stuff there.
And Leon, I would imagine in your very competitive world, the notion of environmental sustainability these days is absolutely vital.
Yeah. So that's also a big part of our design. Well, always in our designs, is to use things that that is more organic and, like you say, sustainable. So when I arrived there, the design wasn't built yet. So now you arrive in Singapore, and now you need to quickly build the things that you need to do. And at Changi Airport, which is a beautiful green airport, they had a team maintaining their outdoor trees, and they were pruning their trees quite harshly. And there was a lot of branches lying next to the road, and I decided, okay, so instead of using steel and, you know, all kinds of other materials, I decided let's pick up all of these branches and let's whittle them down into the sculpture that we want to create. So that was the first thing. So we use material that was locally in the streets, literally old tree branches. And then we only use the same wood, some little pieces of metal, and then organic material all around.
And Leon, African or South African garden design, how do you think it stacks up against the rest of the world in terms of sustainability, creativity and innovation?
I think when it comes to sustainability, we're right on top there. I mean, our weather patterns here are so variable. Sometimes it's extremely wet, sometimes it's very dry. So when it comes to landscape designers also, we push for plants that can take our environmental factors. And especially with plants that are local, when it comes to indigenous or even endemic to a certain area. And we were one of the first countries to really push that theory towards gardens. I mean, when you go to Europe, they have lovely gardens full of flowers. But say, for instance, you're in Germany, there's hardly any German plants used. They just use all of these little pretty things that you buy at the nursery, but it's not promoting their local heritage, which they have in their mountains, which have some beautiful things. And that is where South Africa is in the top tier when it comes to using our local plants and also plants to adapt to our climate.
And Leon, a final question. What does it take to consistently win awards at prestigious events like this?
Yeah, a lot of whiskey. I'll be honest, it's a little bit stressful because when you win a show, you have to keep up with that standard or go higher. There's a lot of expectation. And you do not get invited to another show or competition and event if you don't have a minimum gold or best on show at a show. So to continue the circuit, in the world when it comes to international flower shows and representing South Africa there, you really have to think out of the box a little bit in order to stay there.
I can think of nothing nicer, Leon, than sitting in one of your gardens having a fine single malt with you. Maybe we'll
but
do that sometime.
we're rebuilding the Chelsea Flower Show in Stanford, which is in September. So I invite everybody to come and have a look at our Protea display, which opens on the 21st. It's one of the very few shows that's ever taken back to a country to show to,
wow,
to its people.
Of course, I didn't even reference your success at the Chelsea Flower Show earlier in the year as well. Leon Kluger, thank you very much for talking to us today and for bringing home the glory. And just before I bid you farewell, on our last online poll, I asked you this question: is food security in South Africa under control? And I suggested three options: one, that it is; two, the risk is rising; and three, we need a new strategy. And interestingly, there is growing concern among our respondents. 30% say the risk is, or we need a new strategy, but 58% say that the risk is rising. So that certainly is something to heed. On our poll today, and it's ahead of an interview that we will run tomorrow, the changing habits of television set purchase. And I'm asking you if you have switched to a big screen, if switching to a big screen is too expensive, or size doesn't matter at all. If you have a view on that, I invite you to go to either our X or our LinkedIn pages. And that's where we are going to leave it. That's our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We are then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.